that use various devices to tempt you to play with them. We had started when the interview business began. This is Michael DiBianco's Memory Incorporated. Now watch this when it comes up. Now, I'm not going to do anything. It just he's timed it so it automatically goes to the next screen. And this is his novel. I'm going to take you through because he has some interesting use of images at one point, if I remember where they are. Again, I'm not doing anything. They're set up that you get taken through the series of images which is protagonist. And then you get to the next section. This is a cyberpunk science fiction novel set in the future in which people purchase memories from other people. And part of this he was trying to create was the effect of the visual memories, the visual montage, which would be created by this kind of experience. This is, as you see, on the World Wide Web. He's made great use of icons and color and backgrounds and the rest. And I suggest that what you might want to do is to, since I've placed all of these, I think there should be a copy of all of the cyberspace web with all of the student and other documents on each of the three machines. Even after I go, I'll leave them here, explore them. You can copy any to any of your own disks and just try modifying different things. That's one way to use some of these, you know, techniques and learn how to do them. Okay, now, I was trying to think of what the best thing to do would be. I was going to give a talk on, let me just see. These are various hypertext fictions and poems, some of which we've looked at briefly. Yes, we've seen some of this. We took a quick look at Patchwork Girl. I wanted to show you sort of one of the educational things that came out of it, and how people, how we put together a mini web. And again, you might want to look at this as you read Patchwork Girl. Now, the author of the last work, Michael DiBianco, took this My logo and created a new one. And a background, and so we decided that he would design this. We took his design over. Each one of these are students' reactions to the hypertext fiction Patchwork Girl, Patchwork Girl's place in Blade Runner, for example, a reading of Patchwork Girl. This one is very witty. Scars, seams, and links. So since these are all scars in the Frankenstein monster, he made all the links as scars. And each one of these is a slightly separate, you know, background. And you can follow this through. This is a mini web inside the main one. And many of the comments that we have talked about, such as the fragmenting the self, the notion of the author, are all picked up and discussed in this web. And you notice I call it this web, even though it is part of a much larger one. It is this web only insofar as we are looking at it. I'm going to go and close the door. Notice that design principle that you can create the borders of your text that we mentioned before. This is one publication, if you will. That's the cyberspace web. This, it belongs to the section on the body, the section on hypertext, but there's another publication called the Electronic Book Review. I have nothing to do with it, except I've published something in it, and one of the things that I published is my essay on Patchwork Girl. So this document is part of books that exist in two widely different places, geographically widely different. Can't go to this because it's local here. Where is mine? This is my review. This is what started it all off. And again, I took her images and made a collage out of them. And that's what I wanted. I wanted to suggest something to you, that when you have multiple images and multiple texts that link together, what you're going to find is you inevitably get a form of collage. And therefore, that this is a nice lead-in to my discussion of hypertext as collage, and I'm going to do that using a story space web. So let me put this away for now. Again, I'm tantalizing you, inviting you to look at some of the student and other works which I'm leaving here. Obviously, do as much as you can this week. Let me find out where I put this. You'll notice I've put a lot of the student webs now directly on the machine, the things that you've looked at. So at least one of the machines will have these various story space webs that I've used as lectures or things I've shown you. These are for you to play with. If you want to experiment, one good thing to do is duplicate the web. Go click on something like Patchwork Girl, go to Archive, and go to Duplicar, and make your own copy, rename it, and then open it up and play with it. Then you don't have to worry if you erase something, because that's the thing about digital text, an image. It doesn't cost anything to do this. And that's a good way of getting and practicing. We're missing a couple of people, Jose, aren't we? We've got three short, I think. Oh, that's life. That's okay. No. Well, I was playing with this, so I moved it around. This is the title page. Hypertext as collage. And this is a hypertext fiction, which I'll show you a little bit of. And again, I believe I've left it on the machines for you. Being in part an appropriation of collage between writing and painting. And it's by two people. This is really an object case for writing webs and creating webs, because it seems to represent what happens in a lot of cases. First of all, I think it's clear when you look at this, this story space web gives the impression of a collage. What has happened is the author has written it so different parts come up and arrange the tile over so that you can read back and forth across the text, and they give different interpretations of something going on. It's not clear if there's an earthquake or someone's having a drug reaction or they're going mad, and different people are in different worlds at the same time. This, in fact, is the collage between writing and painting. Now you'll notice Pierre Jarry's name comes first and mine comes second. How did this come about? I belong to a discussion group that's not really functioning very much anymore, but for about 2 years was very active, called Technoculture. And it was about digital culture. And this person had done some performance art. as part of his graduate degree. And he did a performance at a seminar in, it was either La Jolla or Irvine, I can't remember where. And years later, he said, I thought people might be interested in this. And he just took the individual texts, each one separated by space, and sent them out as email to everybody on this group. And I took a look at it, and I said, this is so obviously segmented, divided into sections, that it really calls out to be put into hypertext. I downloaded it onto my desktop, and it took about 15 minutes to create a story space web out of it. And then I sent him some mail and said, would you like to see it? And he was excited by the idea. But let's look at this and see how I made it, because that's part of what's of interest here. Well, we could look at the term collage. And you have several, you can go right to the end of the web if you want, if there is an end. And part of this here, let me make this larger for you, is from the dictionary, I think, is the Petit Robert, yes. Collage is the act of gluing, collage d'une affiche, state of what is glued, and so on and so forth. But at each point, such as Picasso, or assemblage through adhesion, or Petit Robert, you can click on this. So let's choose Picasso. Well, he didn't have the original images, because this was just an email, so I went to a text and I scanned this in, and then this is attached to a text by, in America, one of the best known art histories, written by German emigre H.W. Janssen, on the history of world art, and this is a discussion of the importance of collage in 20th century art. Why did Picasso and Braque suddenly prefer the contents of the paper basket to brush and paint? And then you have a choice here. And you can keep branching. Now, this is in his original, let me just close up some of these because this is an inevitably smaller screen. You can go to any one of these individual people. There's a dedication. There's a list of who's in it. These are things about both of us. So if you can hear, these are all the references to Tarza. So this is an extremely heavily linked and interlinked story space web, one that would be very difficult to put on World Wide Web, because what you would have to do is make a list with every one of those things as a separate document. You could, if you liked using frames, put the list in the left frame, that's the left column, and the right could be each changing definition or each changing lexia. But that makes a very clunky, ugly, kind of page unless it's very well done. So just take the first one. And you'll notice something about how this document takes form. Does this differ, Isabel, from a normal scholarly or art theorist essay? Is there anything odd about this? If this were a normal essay, what would you expect to see at the beginning of Tristan Tarza's remark? A title? But in electronic space, what you tend to do is just take whole chunks and put the whole chunk there. In some way, it seems more honest. It's so much easier to copy, you tend to let the author speak for the author, and you don't have to introduce it. The introduction comes by way of the link. So it starts to create a different kind of writing. If you tried this in a normal essay, it would look very funny. And most readers would be very annoyed because they would find it hard to follow. It's not hard to follow here. When you have a list of things about Tarza, you click on one and a whole statement by Tarza comes up, you're say, what is this person doing? This isn't an essay. So there's something that's going on differently here. Okay, what else could we do? Let's go back to this one. That was, you notice what we've done is linked together in multiple ways a selected series of documents. He first chose a whole series. To that, I added a few that his documents seemed to call for. And then having finished that, I said, this looks to me, we should really talk about hypertext as collage, not just collage. So this is a second stage. Okay. And you can go directly to the end if you want. The end, a universal picture, as though this were a film, cinema, and you were playing with that. You could also take this in various different directions. This is the structure of the entire web. So let's take a look at, what is this? These are comments in his web about literary collage. Well, then I decided to add hypertext collage. And you can, this is a clue. What does this word tell us? Yeah. As Sue points out, it's something must have come before it, or why would you have the word or? It's also meant to be a little dislocating. You're not used to starting things in the middle. It's done in literary terms. Lawrence Stern does it, James Joyce does it, people have always done it, but it's not usual. This is meant to remind us that this is coming as a fragment. Okay, text appears as digital, hypertext appears as digital collage. What would you think we would find, Pedro? What would you expect to find where this says hypertext is linked? What would you expect to find there? What else, possibly? Something about hypertext. In other words, if you have something about here, if this is a link, you'd expect to see something about the subject that's named. That's the kind of rhetoric of departure I'm talking about. Each one of these is a topic. Let's just stick with things like juxtaposition. Well, an example. You've seen Breath of Sighs already. In Nathan Marsh's Lexias and Breath of Sighs, they place themselves around the screen, as we've said at the opening, making this into a kind of digital collage. Notice you have a choice. You could go back to the list, or you can keep going in a line. We're continually giving the reader a choice of how to move through the web. The reader can always go back to the window in this environment, but you make it even easier. This is the In Memoriam web. This is an academic web, and it has several overviews. This is a poem that's divided into 133 parts, but it's meant to be read as a criticism of the normal elegy, because the poet feels that when people die and one writes a poem about them, you shouldn't write the orthodox, normal poem in which first you feel bad, then you feel a little bit better, then you feel all better. Because he says time doesn't work that way. At the moment after the person dies, you feel good and then you feel bad. Years later, the loss comes upon you. So the poem is a continual multi-linear approach to time, grief, and recovery. The way of presenting that in hypertext, because it is a proto-hypertext poem, it's hypertext before the technology, is to allow readers to go through different lines of development. And one of the ways that one can do that is to read the poem in terms of different images. In this case, the image of the hand is very important. One of the students created that drawing of the hand, which we scanned in. But to take advantage of this and to keep these different lexias from becoming confusing, one of my grad students from Norway, Jun Lannestad, worked very hard to arrange these things so when you open them in different orders, you'll be able to find your way through on the screen without having to use links or anything else. That's another way of both creating a collage, but aiding reader navigation and orientation. Am I speaking too fast, Juan Maria? Slow down a little bit. Okay. Appropriation. Obviously, the hypertext and the collage works by putting things often unexpectedly next to one another. But also, as we've seen in all of these things, appropriation. We take things that may or may not belong to us. This is true of the origin of this web, which is why it's paradigmatic. I took someone else's web. Let's see this one. And Ulmer, it's not necessary to repeat the historical account of how collage became the predominant, all-pervasive device of the 20th century arts. And this is really my starting point. Ulmer has had a real influence on my thought. He makes many good remarks. To lift a certain number of elements from works, objects, pre-existing messages, and to integrate them in a new creation in order to produce an original totality manifesting ruptures of various sort. Remember, hypertext can be thought of from two different directions, two different ends of the axis. You can think of it first as links bridging. You know? Links are bringing together, creating homogeneous document. But you could also say, in a Derridean manner, we would not need links if there weren't gaps to begin with. So you can think of the hypertext as essentially bridging successfully and joining things that were meant to be joined, or you can think of hypertext as a compensation for the fragments and the ruptures that exist between ideas, between people, and different hypertext authors and artists take different attitudes towards the link and to what extent you emphasize rupture and break and to what extent you emphasize unification. I don't know if that could be considered a political meaning of it, but we could take it that way. Now if we go to here, this takes us actually back to the index. It also, one would expect, it would take us to a biography of Ulmer or a list of his works or something like that, but in this case it doesn't. Let's go to this one. This is an example, we looked at this yesterday, of appropriation because, and as you'll see, if we have the word appropriation, a good rhetoric of arrival is in this long text, in this complicated screen, if one uses the word appropriate, if we link just to that, and in this case, story space highlights that, the reader knows why he or she has arrived here. Because this, we followed the word appropriates, takes, and sure enough, it's in here. Then the reader, with that assurance, goes back and reads the entire passage. Why is this appropriation? Because Carlos Eisenman Stern has taken various images from textbooks and from medieval, Renaissance works on cosmology and simply appropriated them and dropped them into his novel in the same way that Jordis and I took Tristan Tarza's ideas or Picasso's statements or Janssen's statements and, with attribution, dropped them in. Yes? Well, there are a couple of issues here, Jose. One of them is that I think print authors are more sensitive about print authorship than about image authorship. And so he's more careful in writing his narrative about attributing, though in fact many of these attributions are make-believe. They're not real. He's made them up. And he didn't think of making up his images. Though I think some of the images are actually attributed. They say they are Harvey's images who discovered the circulation of the heart. But you're right, this tends to go this way. Images are just taken. Part of this is the way the images were found. Many of these people at the very beginning took images from collections of clip art. That is, these are assemblages of art that you can use freely without violating copyright, and they often do not identify the source. So part of it is the way they came upon the images rather than intentional. There's a mixture of things here. But sometimes students create works which are without attribution. I've had students create collaborative webs in which the individual authors do not identify the sections. We had an experimental class story, narrative, called the No-Tell Motel. It's a parody of Robert Hoover's well-known Hotel, which was a group, it's been going almost 10 years now, an ongoing fiction. Every class adds to it. And one small seminar of mine started to write these. And I said that the only requirement was that people had to put their initials on it, and they could not change anyone else's writing. I mean, I thought anybody could, but they made the rules. They decided everybody had to identify themselves. And you can be sure, as soon as there's a rule, some writer wants to break it. So what we found people doing was something like this. Down here, where they're supposed to identify things, someone would put, like, GPL, as though they'd done it. And then they'd save it. Then it would turn out it was actually done by Steve Rose. But he had pretended that I had written it. And then he saved it like that. Now, if you're a very careful reader on a computer, you know you're not at the bottom of the screen. So essentially, some of these people created false authorships. And the only clue is here, you know, that, and that you say, wait a minute, that's not the end. So we've had all kinds of approaches to authorship, and anonymity, pseudonymity, straight out lying, any way of playing games with it. Yes, Benedette. Yes. Berta, we want to come up here and just speak into this so people could hear it.
Well, you could repeat it.
I want to make sure I understand your question. I think Bernadette's question was, if we don't have attributions in copyright, how are people going to make a living from the internet? Good question. Most poets and writers now don't make money from their work. You make, at least in America, people make money teaching or on fellowships or things, of, you know, or doing other things, such as working in lighthouses, as an acquaintance of ours does. But the interest in how you can make money in the internet is very real now. One obvious way, and there have been some people who've done this, is you have subscriptions, like a magazine. And you publish with a publisher or magazine, and a library has to pay so many dollars or pesos a year to have access. And then anyone connected to that can read it free. The authors actually end up making more money than they do with book publishing. Because in fact, it's much, much cheaper to publish this way. So more of the amount of money charged can be much less, and much more of it can go to the author. We'll see to what this is one of the most important issues now, how people are going to make money and how artists are going to make money from publication on the internet. We don't know at the moment. Most people are just delighted because they have what to them is a free method of distributing their work worldwide. And that is so much more important than, you know, at the moment, because it ties into exhibitions and all sorts of other things. But what about people who only want to exhibit on the internet? That is, their art is totally digital. Well, we'll have to find out how that's going to be done.
Excuse me, that I think we...
Because it's the end of internet when the paying is coming. Then everything is... Reclame is coming and that's all.
I don't think... I don't understand...
I hate to talk about paying, but...
Paying or paying?
Money.
Money, good, okay.
But when the money is coming in, then everything will change, and then it's over with internet.
I'm not sure. I don't think so. I mean, we've had poetry and all sorts of things, and there have been free presses and pamphlets and underground and samizdat writing. It depends. There's no one form of internet more than or one form of hypertext any more than there's one form of print. There are many, many different ways of doing things like this.
There are already a lot of people working on side of that. I mean, people who are not in the street, they're already trying to figure out how to do it.
Lauren said that there are already a great many people trying to find a practical, fair, money-making way to create a kind of cyber cash for art, you know, for galleries and things like this. See, if a lot of people look at something and you only charge 2 pesetas, and yet a million people see it, you'll make more money than you will going to a gallery.
So you have many more people entering, like, for example, you have much more people entering the website
than you actually
enter the
Wiki
itself.
I had one more question. In showing us one of your students' websites, there was this period where he had taken control from the viewer and used the element of time. And I think that this is maybe interesting in relationship to your discussion about collage, because I think many of the people here are involved in what are called time arts.
Time-based
Or time-based work. And I'm curious as to if you could maybe tie this, and this is a very general question, to this question of hypertext and some of the historical indices that you gave earlier about the history of text, the history of writing, and what this issue of temporality and the author's ability to control time means to this more textual work that you're showing.
Well, Chris, I'd say if I had another week, .. But Chris has got a really crucial point here. What is the relation to text on the one hand and all time-based media on the other? Because as soon as you start to think about time-based media, you have a much more passive audience. is it possible to have true hypermedia where the reader does more than just choose which passive activity he or she will have? That in turn relates to another factor, namely, what about virtual reality? That is, what about immersive technologies where you appear to be within an environment? Now, there are various kinds of implications about notions of representation and the political implications of these means of representing or producing a reality. The thing I like about text, but then I come out of a literary and art historical background. The thing I like about text is its artificiality, its distance, its fact that you can pick it up and put it down when you need to and you're interested in it, or when you're able to. Time-based media really command you in a particular way, but also in many times, as we've seen with the speaking voices, are much less efficient. That is, they require much more in the way of resources for the amount of information and sometimes even emotion, you know, depending, whatever you mean by information, emotion, concepts, shapes, whatever. We have therefore made our culture around certain types of abilities. It is considered more important to be able to abstract things. That's a strength and a weakness. Many artists hate the element of abstraction, or they hate the element of abstraction they're not working with. But what will happen with virtual reality or more attention to time-based? Suppose we could control or write with, anyone could write with time-based media. Give an example. Doesn't even have to be very, you know, sophisticated, digital. Suppose any time a child in primary school were asked to write an essay on an elephant. If that child could quickly grab a bit of film, digital or analog, and drop it into the essay, so that the child did not have to learn how to describe the shape of the elephant, or its size, or its habits, or its general impression. What might become interesting is that students would become adept at finding information and pasting it in place, but they would lose the ability to do certain kinds of abstractions that we prize now, that are the sign of intellectual excellence. This is not new. Every information technology comes at a real cost. Plato has Socrates complain that as soon as we learn to write, it will destroy our memories. And he's basically right. More and more, over the centuries, over the millennia, people commit less to memory. 75 years ago, it was common in universities and secondary schools throughout the Western world to expect students to learn thousands of lines of poetry. The idea was you would carry that with you. You did not need a text. As text became cheaper and cheaper, with the invention not of printing, but of steam or electrical driven printing, the idea of having to, you know, carry so much information seems silly. Isn't this another example of what could happen with virtual reality? It will change to some extent the way we will, I mean, this is a dystopia, a negative vision. This is a possibility. From one point of view, hypertext, as I present it, is conservative because it is another form of reading. Whereas, depending on the time-based media, is really not depending on reading except in the semiotic sense, the, you know, decoding. My criticism of time-based media is that they take a lot of time. They tend to be, in that sense, imperialistic. If you have a video that takes an hour, you have to get someone who's willing to give up an hour of their life. But you could say, well, people give up an hour of their life to watch football matches or, you know, or soap operas. Well, that's their choice. and you are competing with that. You can process much more information in a shorter period of time, but it's a different type of experience and a different type of information. I think of some of the paintings that one sees in from the 1960s on. And I, at the time I was, you know, I spent most of my time as a young person defending modern art against older people, my parents, you know, their generation. Then at a certain point, I became increasingly interested in 18th and 19th century painting, often very, very precise depictions of things. Painting that allows you to see things you would probably not be able to see without the painting, because our eyes, we may look, but we don't see. But I realized each one of these wonderful paintings takes up about so much room. If you are the Tate Gallery, or the Whitney, or the Guggenheim, whether it's in Bilbao or not, if you put one of these gigantic paintings up on the wall, that one has seen from the 60s, these pictures are 30 feet long, that means you have to take 50 other smaller pictures out and put them in storage. I mean, that, among everything else, is a major artistic statement. The person who picks that one big painting, like a Helen Frankenthaler with a splash and stain, says, my painting is more important than 70 paintings by Turner and Rembrandt and so-and-so, and you have to give me the space. There's this kind of grandiose statement, very characteristic of the 60s, one of the great ages of egomania in, I think, Western culture. Now, look, that, it seems to me that a lot of time-based media make that same demand upon the viewer's this is not a very fashionable point of view, I should say. As a museum person, I don't think Jose will necessarily agree with me. Yes?
I think it takes less time to watch a movie than read a book.
It depends if you count up the amount of information that's in it. I wouldn't think so. Yeah.
So you have more information and more things from a book than from a movie?
Different kind.
Different
kind of information.
But there's no quality involved.
Oh, there's an enormous quality difference. And you have
for
to
you.
Choose if you like the quality.
But that's
I mean, there are times in my life when I
that's
much prefer...
That's a very subjective point of view, I think.
As an author, you must make this choice, too.
Of course. Of course. And the question is, at the moment, we have choices between video and film, you know, and hypertext and static media and all sorts, and they're all existing together. And therefore, it really is a matter of artistic choice and viewer choice. But what will happen when one media becomes really dominant? In most ages, one or two media or genres tend to dominate. What will happen? I've only been selling the good things. Now I'm raising some really nasty questions for you to argue about. I mean, I happen to love cinema, you know, and love video. But think of it from a theoretical point of view, what it implies. Or you could say the same thing about a book. There are many parents who tell children, put down that book and go out and play. Experience real life, you know. Don't spend all your time with your nose in a book. I mean, many people consider any excessive attention paid to any form of media to be a loss. Other people say, no, you don't need another reality, one is enough. Virginia Woolf said, art doesn't imitate reality, one of the damn things is enough. And so the idea that the world is or the media of all sorts create a different world for us, a pastoral world, an alternative world, a laboratory world, is very exciting to many artists. Of course, if you're going to take this position, that raises real problematics about the political implications of any art form which claims to accurately describe political situations, because you're claiming a kind of authenticity in that, which suddenly begins to erode when you begin to pay attention to the relation of this. It's not insurmountable, but it's, I think, something you have to be aware of if you're interested as some work with. As I said, I'm not really against video and film. I just want to wake you up a bit, get you thinking about these, because people are talking about issues like this. And you have to have some sort of an answer to some of these things, right? If political and other so-called practical implications are important.
I was thinking, and I think that in some point, the hypertext, is not a bit. I think that for example, the internet is more open in the way that you can choose what you really want to choose. For example, if you are reading like a book, for example, and you need to find information about something, you can connect with different libraries, for example, and to get more information, no? I think that...
Well, you're defending hypertext, basically. I agree.
No. Yeah.
The internet is a form, various forms of hypertext. Even using gophers and search tools is still a form of hypertext. Sue.
That reminds me of something you said yesterday that I was going to ask you about. You said the web wasn't really hypertext. Can you define what you see as really hypertext and why you said that?
Sure. I was really going to do that tomorrow, but I'm willing to do that today. I would think to be really hypertext, the author, readers have to be able to be complete authors. You can't add links